Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to this week's Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. This is Bill Corey, sports editor of the Providence Journal. With me is our Red Sox writer, Bill Koch. Bill, I'm proud to report that I had my second shot of the COVID vaccine over the weekend, and I came through with flying colors. I got a little tired on the night of the shot, but really that was the extent of it. I was up and at them the next day, and I can't wait till my full superpowers kick in a couple of weeks here.
That's great news, Bill Corey. Congratulations.
Thanks. It'll be nice to get past all of the fear and concern and stuff. And not that we won't have any, but I think it'll be much subsided. And once we have most of our neighbors and friends and family members vaccinated, I think we can ditch the masks when we're outside and actually see people and shake their hands again and stuff. It'll be nice to return to some sense of normalcy.
I can tell you from experience that it is a feeling of relief. It is freeing. You don't realize sometimes, I think, when you're walking around with mental burdens. I think we're just so engineered to keep going forward and keep trying, and you go to work the next day whether you're sick or tired or you feel sad about something, you just go.
Yeah,
it's what you do, and especially in media, with what we've had to go through the last 14 months trying to cover some of this, you haven't been able to make certain plans, you haven't been able to schedule anything, and it feels like you're constantly on quicksand.
Yeah,
getting that second shot and receiving full immunity eventually, it's gonna firm up that base a little bit more for you.
Yeah, and along the same lines, and obviously this is a Red Sox podcast, so we'll get to the Red Sox in a minute, but along the same lines, we had high school football championships this past weekend, which
yes.
You were a big part of our coverage, and it was good to see that the seniors, the high school athletes, had a season. Certainly football players were able to play their Super Bowls and got that in because, so many student athletes, particularly last spring's athletes, were robbed of that opportunity. But it must have been, pretty encouraging to be there and see the teams and the fans and sort of the atmosphere of high school sports again.
Aside from the fact that, obviously, we're playing Super Bowls in May, which has never happened before.
Right.
Everything else felt very normal.
Yeah.
Which I take as a great sign.
Absolutely. And a congrats to all of the Super Bowl champions here at here in Rhode Island who play in the RIIL, and certainly to the teams that came out on the other end of the scoreboard. It was a great season for them to get there as well. And here we are looking at spring sports in the state. So that's certainly an encouraging sign. So speaking of encouraging signs, Bill, our Boston Red Sox, as it were, are the number one team in the latest USA Today baseball power rankings, which I guess comes as no surprise since they have the best record in baseball, I believe. They're at 22-13. I saw that Rafael Devers had a few comments after yesterday's victory, basically saying, you guys didn't really believe in us, or, the media basically it's always the media's fault. But
of course.
So, which, hey, it's great. Whatever motivation the Red Sox need, and if that's what they're feeding off of, that's fine. I'm sure the media doesn't really care if that's what it is. But, it's hard to take a team that was as bad as they were last year and really think that they were going to win a championship or finish in first place. But so far, the Red Sox have been proving all the doubters wrong. Here we are in the, almost the second week of May. We're in the second week of May. And, they're still on top of the heap.
I think the difficult part in trying to project them as being a team that could have the best record in baseball 1 year after what they did last season,
yeah,
is that they didn't really make a splash addition. They made some signings that were sort of around the fringes of the roster that maybe filled in some gaps. But there wasn't someone like a Trevor Bauer who came in. You know, there wasn't a top of the market free agent. There wasn't a blockbuster trade where you brought in an all-star. There wasn't anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was guys who were a little more under the radar, like Garrett Richards, like Kike Hernandez. Guys who are veterans who certainly have a track record,
yeah,
but who aren't necessarily guys who have lit the world on fire previously. And I think, you know, Boston, if that's what it takes to motivate them, if they want to be a little edgy and a little chippy, I say fine. I think teams find their motivations in all sorts of different ways. And, I mean, how often can we really say that the Red Sox, the mighty, rich Red Sox, can play the underdog card?
Well, that's probably true for most Boston teams. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Patriots are famous for taking motivation from from the most unlikely places when they would say things like nobody believed in us, when basically everybody believed in them and everybody was picking them. But, you know, if they'll find one guy or one writer somewhere who didn't pick them, then it becomes a nobody believed in us.
The Teddy Bruschi, Mike Vrabel, Rodney Harrison version of the Patriots could find disrespect in anything.
Right. Hey, whatever it takes. Right?
They were great.
Absolutely. Before we get carried away here, now the Red Sox have played all of 35 games, and we're not 25% into the season yet.
Right.
But there certainly have been some highlights so far, and the fact that they are still holding their position here at the top of the American League East is no small feat, particularly with the play of the New York Yankees of late, who are now 3.5 games behind, and I think have gone like 13-6 since they were swept by the Rays last month. And we were chatting about this a little earlier. I mean, it was really only a matter of time before that roster and that team began to resemble their baseball cards.
There's too much talent there, particularly in the lineup. You didn't think that Gleyber Torres and DJ LeMahieu were going to be terrible all season.
No.
there's just really no way that's going to happen. I think the big bonus for New York is the fact that Giancarlo Stanton looks like the Marlins version of Giancarlo Stanton.
Boy, he really has kind of come to life as of late, yeah.
And that guy, when he was in Miami, was an absolute wrecking machine.
Right.
You know, if it's always been whether or not he could stay healthy.
Yeah.
It's rarely been a question of his ability. It's been a question of whether or not he could stay on the field.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing the type of damage that he's capable of doing, with that bat.
Yeah, and their pitching has kind of come around as well. Corey Kluber has kind of found himself a little bit to kind of become a number two there to Gerrit Cole. But, yeah, I mean, the Yankees, they just have too much talent to be residing in the bottom of the American League East. And I think that's going to be, it should make for a fun summer. It's always better when when the Red Sox and the Yankees are both good and the rivalry kind of opens a new chapter. So, we'll see. It's kind of a pleasant surprise because, frankly, I didn't think, and I'm probably one of the people that Devers was referring to, although I haven't written anything. I didn't think the Red Sox would be in first place on May 10th. I think I picked them to win between 80 and 85 games and figured they'd be somewhere in the third place, maybe second place kind of thing. But, so far so good. And actually, there's a couple of players I think we should, at least I'd like to point out, that have helped them get there so far. And let's start on the pitching first. And Nick Pivetta had another good outing yesterday, and he's been and you pointed this out to me, and I wasn't aware of this. He's been like almost perfect, or in terms of wins and losses, since he became a member of the Red Sox last year. I think one of the things that I found interesting was that he kind of credited, or had some nice words for Jason Varitek to kind of help him, help him with his performance. But Pivetta is so far living up to the potential that all those other teams initially had and then eventually didn't have with him. So what's your take on Pivetta so far?
He's made 9 starts with Boston. He's 7-0. Opponents are hitting less than 200 against him.
Yeah.
I think when Pivetta is in the zone, he has good enough stuff to get people out. He's proven difficult to hit. The walks can be a problem at times. He's got 22 in 36 and two-thirds innings. That's a little high. You know, but the fact is, he's only allowing six hits per nine.
Right. Right.
He's been very difficult to put a rally together against without a little help from him. You know, we saw that early in the game on Sunday. He had a couple walks in the first inning. Then there's a single. He's down 1-0. You know, has a 30-pitch first inning. Without that, he's going deeper into the game. He's probably giving you seven innings. You know, he's going to keep the bullpen a little fresher. You know, but I think the stuff plays. I mean, he's got, you know, he's got a good fastball. He's using his slider, you know, twice as much as he did with the Phillies, and I think he's pointed to that as something really important in his pitch mix, a change that the Red Sox wanted him to make. You know, throw more sliders, less curveballs. It's a better pitch for you.
Yep.
You know, and it certainly worked. And I think, you know, it just goes back to the trade last August. You know, Chaim Bloom makes a trade. He sends two relievers to a team that was desperate to get into the playoffs.
Right.
And they send you back a starter who they're frustrated with in Pivetta, and a prospect starter in Connor Siebold, who, you know, they might have seen is a couple levels away, and, you know, he's 25, and is he ever actually going to get there? You know, maybe they thought that you know, his clock was sort of running a little bit, and maybe, you know, maybe he's a little older, you know, sort of aging out of that prospect status.
Right, right.
You know, in hindsight, it's a very good deal for Boston.
Absolutely. It's been great so far. I mean, he's 5-0 with the team this year. He's got like 35 strikeouts and almost 37 innings of work. So certainly, you know, working out just fantastic for them. And somebody else I guess I want to shout out, give a shout out to, is that, and that's Garrett Richards, who didn't have the best outing in his last start, didn't match what he had done previously, but, you know, he went seven innings for them, and they won the game pretty handily. So they had a, you know, pretty good lead. I think he gave up four runs or something like that in that inning, in that game, maybe three. But you know, that's key right now, because as you pointed out, that means you're not eating into the bullpen, and he certainly looked a lot better the last few starts than his first few starts.
Yeah, he made a mechanical adjustment against the Mets, and he's carried that through in his last few outings. You know, you have a game like he pitched in over the weekend where you're ahead 11-4, and that ultimately ends up the final. What do you want out of a starting pitcher at that point?
Right.
Get us deep into the game.
Yeah.
You know, give a couple guys a day off out of the bullpen. Maybe we can get some position players off their feet.
Yep.
At that point, it's all about management. It's not necessarily about him going out there and giving you one run, three hits, no walks, you know, 10 strikeouts.
Right.
The offense has done enough. It's good enough.
Right.
It's just important for him
just don't
to
blow
go
it.
Out there and give you some length. That's right.
Right. Right.
That's right.
And he has been, and that's great. So that kind of brings us to the bullpen, which is kind of a tale of two cities for me, Bill, and for a lot of people here. Mm. The back end of the bullpen, I think, has been very encouraging. Matt Barnes has looked fantastic. The other Garrett there, Garrett Whitlock, has looked pretty good. Adam Ottavino is kind of up and down. You know, we know he's got the stuff. It's just a matter of his putting it together. But my main concern, and I think a lot of Red Sox fans' main concern right now, is sort of that middle relief core, which it's just, you know, it's early in the season. Maybe they're not really, you know, settled into their roles yet quite, you know, quite as they would later in the year. But it's still, they bring this, like Austin Bryce, or, you know, even Sawamura has not been fantastic. It's, you know, that's, I guess, where, but, you know, there's a reason why you're a middle reliever in the major leagues, right? I mean, if you are a really good reliever, you're probably the closer or the setup guy or the late innings guy. And if you're really, really good, then you're probably a starter. So if you don't fall into those two camps, then you're pitching the fifth, right?
You're right.
Or the sixth or whatever. So I suppose, you know, it's a first world problem, but I would like to see a little bit more consistency in that middle relief.
You're exactly right. That's exactly how pitching is broken down. You just said it perfectly. You look at the Red Sox bullpen and how they're used and what situations they're used in. You can certainly see a defined sort of circle of trust, I guess you could say.
It's not very big.
It's
right.
not big enough at this point.
Yeah.
You know, they certainly trust Matt Barnes. He's been great.
Yep.
He's also appeared in 17 games out of 35. That sort of pace isn't sustainable over 162. Adam Ottavino has appeared in 16 games. Josh Taylor has 15 appearances. You know, these guys will not be able to continue at that pace over 162. And so you need something from Sawamura. Austin Bryce the other night has a 7-run lead, hits 3 batters. They end up going to Taylor to rescue him. It's an 11-6 final.
Right, right.
That comes after Austin Bryce pitching midweek last week with a 6-run lead and giving up a 3-run homer. Eventually you get Matt Barnes into that game at the end. So I guess you would look at guys like Bryce, like Sawamura, like Taylor. They have a job to do, and it's to keep the ball out of the hands of Matt Barnes, Adam Ottavino, Darwinson Hernandez, when the score is spread out. You know, and I think in that way, they're just as important as somebody like Barnes. They need to perform in their given role. And you would like to see something a little better than that, and I think that's why the Red Sox made the signing that they did over the weekend, bringing back Brandon Workman.
Old friend who's now down in Worcester, but if all goes well, could be rejoining the Red Sox at some point here in the not-too-distant future. Yeah, so Workman's an interesting case because Workman had a very good stint with the Red Sox from 2013 till 2019 before he was dealt away. And in some of those years, really was a consistently effective reliever. And was the closer in one of those seasons, too.
2019. Yep.
And then was dealt away and did not really have the same kind of success. He went to Philly, and then he was with the Cubs for a little while and kind of flamed out in both places. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know because relievers are kind of up and down. But here's somebody who has succeeded here in Boston. It's not exactly he's not over the hill. So it would be great to see him recapture some of that form. But, yeah, I think that he would be a great addition to that bullpen if he can find some level of what he had before, you know, with the Red Sox.
It's a worthwhile flyer to take. You know, as you said, he's 32. He gets released by the Cubs. He had an ERA over 6.5 with Chicago, an ERA over 6.5 when he pitched with the Phillies last season after the trade for Pivetta and Seabold. So he has struggled for an extended period, but you only have to go back to 2019 and you'll find his best season of his career.
Yeah.
2 years ago. 1.88 ERA. Opponents hit right around 100 against him. Over 100 strikeouts in 70 innings.
Right.
He was fantastic. He gave up one home run all season.
Wow.
He was fantastic.
Right. He had that devastating curveball that he could set up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was fantastic. You know, and if he can give you 70% of that, 80% of that,
right,
you know, something approaching it, he's another worthwhile arm to put out there.
Absolutely. And they picked him up for next to nothing, right?
Nothing.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So. Right off the waiver wire. And he's someone, I think this is important as well. He's someone who still has relationships here.
Yep.
He was drafted and developed by the team. He'd been with the organization since 2010.
Wow.
You know, somebody who can pitch in this market. I don't think that can be overstated either.
Right.
You know, Boston is a demanding place. It can be difficult for some people to excel here. You know, he's proven that he can perform and be consistent here. I think that's important.
It's interesting. He's only pitched in these kinds of markets, if you think about it. The three teams that he pitched for, right? The Phillies, the Cubs, and the Red Sox. These are all baseball crazy cities. You know, it's not like pitching for the San Diego Padres. We always pick on the Padres. I always just go to San Diego when when I need that example of what's a team that nobody cares about. But of course, they're like really good.
My go tos tend to be the Rays and the Royals for some reason.
they're right up there too.
I tend to rip them. I don't know why.
If I was a baseball player and I wanted to play in a place that nobody really cared about, I'd want to be in San Diego, though, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Wouldn't you rather be there than in Kansas City?
Absolutely. Yes.
I also want to point out a couple of the offensive players on the Red Sox and. First off, Xander Bogaerts, I think, has been just consistently good. And this past weekend, it's kind of a wake-up call. Well, it wasn't a wake-up call. It was a reminder of how good he was. He made a couple of really good plays at shortstop. double plays, one in which he snared a hard hit ball and was able to start a double play. Another one was a ground ball in the infield. He was on second base. He took the relay throw, kind of falling off the bag, and he purposely threw it in the dirt to get it to first base quickly.
Yeah.
And Dahlbeck made a nice catch, and they were able to turn the double play. And, you know, you see things like that, and it reminds you, oh, yeah, he's a pretty good shortstop. I realize that he doesn't get a lot of love as a defensive shortstop. And I get that. I'm sure there are metrics that'll tell me how stupid I am. But when you watch him play and you make those and he makes those plays, you know, to me, those are plays that great shortstops make. You know,
he's not Andrelton Simmons out there.
No,
he doesn't have that kind of range.
Right. And that's the big knock on him. He doesn't have the great range.
Correct. Yeah. But generally, when you hit the ball to him, he's going to field it and make a play. And the offense is just elite. I mean, at this point, he's leading the big leagues among shortstops in just about every major category. He's got an OPS approaching 1,000, 10 doubles already, 7 home runs in 33 games. I mean, he has morphed into a slugger over the last 2 or 3 years. And this was a guy who had the hit tool. They knew he was going to hit for average.
Yep.
That's what they liked about him most as a prospect coming up. He was a big prospect, obviously. You know, was a top 5 prospect in baseball before he was promoted. You know, but as he's grown up here, and now he's squarely in the middle of his prime at 28, you take a step back and you realize this is a big guy, strong guy.
Right.
He's capable of hitting the ball a long way, and he's done since 2018, since Cora came in and asked him to tweak his approach a little bit. He's done a lot of damage at the plate.
I mean, he's hitting .349. He's got 7 home runs. He's got 20 RBIs. As you mentioned, he leads the league as a shortstop in almost all the offensive categories and has been doing that really all season long. You know, there isn't much else you could ask of this guy. And he's essentially the captain of the team.
I was going to say.
You know what I mean?
You add on the fact that he's a leader.
Right.
I mean, even better.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, as great as some of the Red Sox players of the past have been, not all of them were the actual leaders of the team. They weren't the guy that you would go and get the quotes from, or the guy that would stand up there after a tough loss and sort of take the blame or you know, talk to the media, whatever. And Bogaerts has pretty much been that guy. So, you know, I think hats off to him. You know, hopefully he will get some league-wide love, because I think that people in Boston know what they have in Xander Bogaerts. But I think across the league, there's always a reason why there's somebody else in front of him in the line, I think.
I don't think it's in everybody's nature to be a leader. I think certainly some guys are more comfortable with it than others. The example I generally go to is Nomar Garciaparra when he was here.
Right.
A terrific player, you know, but didn't want anything to do with the responsibilities of dealing with the media and, you know, sort of being that face every night, that voice every night of the team.
Right.
That sort of went to Jason Varitek over time. You would like your best player to do that.
Right.
It is convenient.
But you can't force that.
You can't force that. And sometimes you should just be content to allow your best player to be great.
Yeah.
It is important in those situations that you have other characters in the clubhouse who are able to assume that role.
Yeah.
You would like them to be more than bit part players. You'd like them to be everyday players, cornerstone type guys. You know, but it is ideal when it's all wrapped in one package, and that's Xander Bogaerts.
Absolutely. I think another person we probably should just not forget to mention is JD Martinez, who continues to tear the cover off the ball. He's got an OPS of over 1,000. He's hitting .333. He's got an OBP of .425. He's got 10 home runs and 31 RBIs. And, you know, so far hasn't hurt himself in the outfield either. But, you know, we've said this before. Hats off to JD, because he stunk last year, and he said he stunk, and he put the work in, and he's back to, you know, watching himself in terms of his at-bats and his swing and his approach and all that. And, boy, it has been paying off. And it is really – it's a whole different ballgame, Bill, when you can watch a Red Sox game and feel pretty confident that no matter the situation – I mean, unless they're down 6 or 7 runs after 3 or 4 innings, you know – that, you know, even if they're trailing by 2 runs or 3 runs or even 4 runs, it's not really over.
No.
Because, you know, you have a few guys that can get on base, and if if they're on base when Xander Bogaerts or Rafael Devers or JD Martinez, you know, or maybe even Bobby Dalbec, who seemed to kind of be finding his stroke lately, you know, all of a sudden you're right back in the game. And that right there is the reason why you want to keep watching the Red Sox, right? Because they're never really out of it.
2 through 5, yeah. The lineup is superb.
Sure.
Alex Verdugo had a 24-game on-base streak that was snapped the other night after I wrote nice things about him. That seems to be the way that works.
you're batting 1,000 in that respect,
I am.
Right?
I am terrible. You know, it never fails. If a reliever has like 15 straight scoreless appearances,
and you do a story about how good they are, and then they're out of the league.
You get shelled the next night, and you know it's all your fault. Happens all the time.
Right.
But Verdugo had a 24-game on-base streak. He hits lefties. He hits righties. He gets, you know, he just gets on against everybody. Martinez hitting third. You know, I asked Verdugo the other night. I said, you know, you saw JD when he stunk last year, and now you're seeing the JD who was here in 2018.
Yep.
What sort of difference does that make? I said, I know it's a, you know, sort of an obvious question. And he said, no, man. He said, go ahead and ask, because it we feel it too. He's like, it's obvious to us, you know, how much different he is. And, you know, it's obvious how much better he makes us.
Yep.
You got Bogaerts hitting fourth. He's been fantastic. And then you have Devers hitting fifth, who's got a 951 OPS, which is like the worst out of the group.
Right.
And you're just, you know, and it's like, geez, you know, it's a nice collection of power hitters when among your 3, 4, 5, 951 OPS is the lowest of the three. I mean, it's fairly ridiculous.
Right.
And you saw, you know, Devers is sort of, he gets into these stretches where he is just incandescent hot. Like, he'll just go crazy.
Right.
Over a 2 or 3 week span and just hit everything that moves. And I think you saw Sunday how and why he's able to get to that point. His first couple at bats, he gets a breaking ball away and he just crushes it to left center. It's an absolute laser beam for a home run. Then later in the game, he gets a fastball up out of the zone, is still able to get to it, and he hits a double to right center field with the base loaded. Another absolute laser. Just the way he is able to make consistent, hard, loud contact on pitches that are in the zone, out of the zone, against lefties, against righties, against velocity, against anything. He really is. He is a savant with the bat in his hands. I can't remember many other Red Sox players in my lifetime who have had the sort of range that he has at the plate in terms of being able to hit good pitches, bad pitches, fastballs, off-speed pitches. His skill set is just so special. It's incredible to watch.
Well, it certainly has been incredible to watch, and it's been great to watch the Red Sox overall. So we've reached the point in the podcast, Bill, where I'm going to start asking you the hard questions about, so how good are the Red Sox in terms of, you know, making noise in the down the stretch and getting to the playoffs? Because you know, they're 35 games in, so things can change, but we've got a pretty good sense of how good they are and a pretty good sense of how some of these other teams are performing. Is it crazy to think the Red Sox are going to win the American League East?
Wow, you really put me on the spot.
Well, I mean, it's early, so we can obviously obviously change our answers over the course of this. But here we are, we're 35 games in, and they are in the lead in the American League East.
I would say this. Yeah. If you tell me that they're going to pitch like this for the next 4.5 months,
yeah,
I'd say they have a really good chance.
Okay.
If you tell me that their starters are going to be able to avoid the IL for the next 4.5 months,
right,
I'd say they have a really good chance. Their personal track records suggest that at least one or two of them will get hurt. You know, you have guys who haven't made 30 starts in a season all that frequently. You know, you've seen a couple injuries over the last week that are going to test their depth going forward. Kike Hernandez is on the IL.
Yep.
He's got a right hamstring strain. Christian Arroyo is on the IL. He's got a left hand contusion. He got hit by a couple pitches on the back of the hand. Incredibly painful the second time.
Right.
You know, and you could tell that it was bothering him. And they've shut down Tanner Houck at Worcester. He's got a flexor strain. They don't think it's anything too serious, but that takes out a depth option in terms of if you need to skip a starter or if you want to, you know, give a guy an extra rest or whatever else, he would have been the first phone call. Connor Siebold's on the IL at Worcester.
Right.
He's got right elbow inflammation. He might have been the second or third phone call. You know, so they're going to be tested a little bit in that way. They've been healthy so far.
Sure. They've been lucky so far.
They have.
I mean, even the injuries have not been anything major, so to speak. At least we don't think so. But yeah, they certainly have been healthy. And you're right. There's always, you know, I think you and I are both thinking of the same guy, Nate Eovaldi. How far is he going to get into the season before something comes up and stuff? But, you know.
Is Rodriguez going to make 30 starts after essentially being down for a whole year and a half?
Right. I mean, that's an unknown.
Is he going to be able to do that? We don't know.
Absolutely. Because you're coming back from an unknown. I mean, people, you know, we haven't been dealing with pitchers with myocarditis much, right?
No.
But, you know, I think, regardless of what you and I think the Red Sox will let us know how serious or how good they think they're going to be when the trade deadline rolls around.
Yes.
And, you know, are there going to be buyers and sellers or sellers? You know, and right now you got to think they're going to be buyers because they, you know, if they are still in the mix, either at the top or the top two or three, or maybe no more than three games out of, you know, contention, you know, maybe you go and try and sign that guy and you're thinking, well, I'm going to get Chris Sale back probably at some point here, late July, early August around.
Yep.
You know, we could really be in for a postseason that people weren't expecting, I guess.
No, I'd say they're probably a year ahead. I think if you gave them some truth serum, I think they might have said that we hope to contend by 2022.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe we'd be a little more aggressive in the third year of what is a rebuild,
right.
Frankly. I mean, no one wants to use that word, but it is.
Yep.
You trade the MVP, you are rebuilding. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you trade Mookie Betts to dump David Price's salary.
You still haven't gotten over the Mookie Betts deal.
I never will. Yeah. I think it's one of the worst personnel moves they've ever made.
Yeah.
Dreadful. You trade a homegrown generational star because you don't want to pay him. That's terrible. Yeah. But I digress. I would say that they're probably a year ahead. And it will be interesting when you get into July when you consider that Massachusetts stadiums are going to go to full capacity on August 1st.
August 1st, yeah.
You're going to have fans in the ballpark. If you have an attractive product out there, you're certainly going to engender some goodwill that you lost trading Mookie Betts and having a terrible 2020.
You know, you bring up an excellent point because that's the other thing. You know, every baseball team, every professional sports team has been hammered throughout the pandemic,
crushed.
Obviously. And so have many businesses, and we shouldn't, you know, obviously. It's not just the millionaires and billionaires who play and own baseball and pro sports teams. But in pro sports, these teams have been crushed. So now you've got a team that's got some legs, let's say. You know, do you go out and just for the sake of keeping fans interested and you know, bodies in the seats, so to speak, I wonder if that plays a role in it too. As you know, I mean, you're not going to do it if you're a terrible team, but if you're a team that's kind of on the fence and in years past maybe the ownership is thinking, well, I don't know if this really is the year to go and break the bank, but you know, hey, we really need to make sure our stadium is full for the rest of the year, you know?
I mean, for goodness sake, you're the Red Sox. You're one of the haves. You should be buying. You should be spending. It doesn't matter what's going on.
Pandemic or not, right?
But that's
not the reality as of late, at least not under what John Henry has sort of laid out over the last few seasons.
No.
Right.
No, I mean, their payroll still is a top three to top five payroll in the sport.
Right.
You can't say that they don't spend money because that's not true. They do.
Right. But a lot of the reason for that is decisions that have been made in under past regimes.
Yes.
It's not, you know, if Chaim Bloom was allowed to just start over with a clean slate and had no players and no salary, I doubt the Red Sox would be one of the top three salaries teams with the highest salaries.
Well, I would tell you that there are probably at least five guys on this roster who wouldn't have the contracts they do.
Right.
I think that's a pretty safe bet.
Yeah.
You know, but I think what fans want to see, based on the Red Sox resources, their recent history, whatever else, is ambition.
Yeah.
I think they want to see ambition. They want to see action.
They want to see belief in themselves.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Right. And that goes a long way in the clubhouse as well. It makes a huge difference among a team when you make a couple personnel moves and you're an obvious buyer. I mean, look what the Bruins are doing right now. Mm. You know, just to go off on a tangent a little bit, the Bruins acquire Taylor Hall, who is a top draft pick, has been an MVP contender, is a clear top forward on any team. The Bruins, Don Sweeney, that's a clear statement of intent from Don Sweeney to guys whose clocks might be running out a little bit, like David Krejci, like Patrice Bergeron. Hey, we're going for it. We brought in this guy. You know who he is. He's a really good player. You know, he made a couple other ancillary moves at the deadline that were designed to buy, to right. strengthen the lineup.
Right.
I certainly think that in baseball, every year when you go to the trade deadline, if you feel like you have a contender and you bring in a splash piece that can help, I certainly think that affects what's going on in the clubhouse. I think the players look at themselves and say, hey, we're buyers. They believe in us.
Right. Right.
You know, they think we're good. Let's give it a shot here. You know, I also think I look at the Red Sox and I wonder, you know, in terms of whether or not they're contending, it is important based on a few of the guys they have in the contract situations they have. Eduardo Rodriguez is a free agent next year. Matt Barnes is a free agent next year. Matt Barnes would bring back a lot if you offered him right now the way he's pitching. Eduardo Rodriguez would bring back a fair amount if he's still healthy going into July and throwing the ball well.
Right.
You've got some other guys who are on one-year deals with club options for next year. Garrett Richards comes to mind.
Mm.
If he's throwing the ball like this all the way into July and he's healthy and his ERA slips under four and he's striking people out like this, a contender would add him as a starter.
Sure.
And they'd also know that they have the security of activating his option for next year.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't necessarily be a straight rental. So you could go two ways with this. I think the front office, the Red Sox, might have designed it purposely that way, knowing that if they didn't contend, if for some reason it didn't work,
right,
they could sell off and try to deepen the prospect base even further. You know, they knew that they had some guys going into walk years. If Aldi's got, you know, a year and a half left on his deal, maybe you explore moving him at some point. I know Alex Speer reported in the Boston Globe there were discussions, preliminary discussions, about possibly trading Eovaldi last year. You know, so those are the types of things that come in when you're not a contender, when you're not necessarily at the top of the division or in a wild card spot. Those are the conversations you don't want to have.
That would be an absolute punch in the gut, though, if this team was contending, you know, in the top, in the mix, let's just say in the mix, and front office decided that they wanted to cash in on the values of some of these players and traded off some of those pieces and, you know, essentially kissed off the rest of the season. Because, man, after last season, that's asking a lot of the fans.
And with fans back.
Right.
And able to vent their frustrations in person.
Yes.
Fenway Park would be a very ugly place.
It's hard to imagine that were to happen. You know, look, if they go on this extended skid and they're 10 games out by, you know, July 15th, it's a different story. But, you know, as of now, it's a pleasant surprise, though, because I really didn't think that the Red Sox would be in this kind of position this, and not that it's that deep, but this deep into the season. We'll see. The warm weather hasn't hit yet, and you know, we'll see how they, if they wilt or they thrive when July and August roll around. But you know, it's encouraging on several levels. The first, obviously, is they're playing very good baseball for the most part. They're in the top spot in the American League East. You have the prospect of Chris Sale coming back later this season.
Yeah.
You have the idea or the possibility of them adding somebody at the trade deadline and them being buyers and not sellers.
Mm-hmm.
So, they are on track, I think, to win back a lot of the... you know, when I think back at our first podcast, one of the things that I think we brought up was, you know, I wonder how the league is going to react and Red Sox fans are going to react to Alex Cora and coming back from the suspension. I haven't even thought about that. That hasn't even really come up. And now maybe we'll be hearing more of that depending on some of the road games the Red Sox have. But, you know, so far... That, you know, the reception of Alex Cora is so far down the line of storylines that it's almost it's not even an issue.
Well, and that's certainly what you hoped, is that the product on the field would take away from that. I also think that, you know, Cora has gone a long way to making it a non-story by owning it. just by being very frank about
it. Right. He takes all the drama out of it.
You know, it's not.
He addresses it enough that it's not this taboo subject anymore.
You know, he's come out and said, you know, a couple times, yeah, when I was suspended last year, and it's like, okay, he's not running from it.
Right.
You know, if he was in the school of denial and it was, you know, oh well, you know, they, you know, MLB, that was a technicality, I didn't really cheat. You know, like you're doing things like that, you're prolonging it, you're making it worse.
Right.
You know, the fact that he's been forthright and said, you know, yes, I was out of baseball last year for, you know, for something I did in Houston and I shouldn't have done it and I missed a season for the wrong reasons, fine.
Yeah.
Good.
Right.
You know, and more importantly, that takes the heat off his players. They don't have to answer it. You know, what do you think of Alex being back? Alex will answer.
That's right. Ask Alex, right.
You know, he's not putting out he's not giving you the Heisman, as we say in media. You know, he doesn't have the handout,
right.
You know, in your face, like, no, we're not going to talk about that. Because what do you do then? You go to the players and say, hey, what's he saying about this behind the scenes? Like, you know, is he upset about it? Is he whatever? He's taking it on.
Yeah.
You know, he's been very forthright about it. And I think that's exactly the right way to approach it and keep it under the surface is by bringing it out into the light. And I think the point you make is a good one. What do they consider contention?
Yeah.
Do they think we have to be in a wild card spot or we have to be leading the division or we're X games out, you know, whatever it may be?
Yeah.
What do they see
what's
contention?
Right. What's their benchmark for contention?
But I think the point you make is a good one in that you have a chance here with fans coming back to the ballpark to welcome them with a decent product, to show them some ambition, to further bury what happened last season.
Mm.
You seem to have a golden opportunity here after 35 games to set up something like that as we get into the summer. And it would be good business. It would be good ownership, good leadership to capitalize on it.
Yeah, and as we've talked about many times, it's been a fun team to watch. You know, just the makeup of the team, the makeup of the roster, the guys that they've added. It's been, and obviously the success on the field makes it a lot more palatable, but it's been generally a fun team to watch.
Hmm.
They're always in the game, you know, that they're able to overcome deficits. They've been hitting very well, generally pitching pretty well. Barnes is one of those guys now, when he comes in, you just expect it's going to be automatic. He's going to get the save. So it's been, you know, so far. I don't know that there's a lot to gripe about with the Red Sox this year so far. So we'll see. We're not 25% into the season yet. We're approaching that benchmark. You know, I don't know that anybody, and certainly I would not have predicted them to be in first place and have the record that they've had and the winning percentage that they've had up to this point. You know, if you asked me back in, you know, March 30th, where do you think the Red Sox are going to be? Bill, talking, you touched upon fans coming back, and the fans will be back for the first time in Polar Park in Worcester this week. On Tuesday, they open up the home portion of their schedule when the Worcester Red Sox host the Syracuse. What the hell are they? The Chiefs? The Sky Chiefs? Something like that?
They used to be.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
The Syracuse team.
The Syracuse team.
At 3 o'clock on Tuesday.
They're just the Syracuse Mets now.
The Mets. That's right. Okay.
Mets.
I know they were the Mets franchise.
They were the Chiefs and the Sky Chiefs all sorts of things. They've gone through, I think they were the Blue Jays affiliate, and then they might have been the Nationals affiliate, and now they're the Mets affiliate.
Yeah.
They've cycled through a few times.
Yeah. That's probably true. I think back when they were the Sky Chiefs, I think they were the Blue Jays affiliate. But anyway, who cares about them?
Yeah, right. Right.
It's really the Worcester Red Sox that are driving the headlines in these parts. So Polar Park, after some cost overruns and a few delays, is up and close to running. It is obviously the home of the former Pawtucket Red Sox. So, you know, Bill, we've talked about this many times, and we don't have to sort of beat a dead horse, but I am interested in going up. I won't be there for the opener, but I'm interested in going up at some point this season just to check the place out.
Sure.
And I think we talked about you're going to probably make a trip up there tomorrow and see what it's like.
Yeah, I think
At Polar Park and what could have been if things went differently here in Rhode Island. But what are you expecting? What have you been hearing about Polar Park? And hopefully it's supposed to be a nice day. We'll see.
It's it's essentially still an active construction site. They're putting the finishing touches on the ballpark,
right?
And, you know, the area surrounding the ballpark, they have several plans in place to improve all the way to 2024,
right?
In terms of hotels and parking garages and
right.
commercial units, so not necessarily the finished product yet.
And they won't have full capacity yet either.
No, they're going to have 25% capacity.
Right.
So, you know, somewhere around 2,300, 2,400 yep. fans.
Yeah. Roughly 10,000 stadium.
But my guess would be just based on track record, just based on Larry Lucchino's track record and Janet Marie Smith's track record, that the park will be very nice. I don't have any doubts about that. I think that the community is going to welcome the Red Sox with open arms.
Right.
City government there and state government there made a very ambitious pitch to the ownership group and was able to secure their move.
Right.
I thought Patrick Anderson, our colleague on news side, did a nice political deep dive last week.
Yep, in the political scene a couple of weekends ago.
Yep, regarding, just the last days of the Paw Sox and, you know, sort of the wrangling that went on in the General Assembly. Some of the conversations between political folks here and ownership there. I think we've gone over the story so many times. It doesn't make it any easier to accept that the top affiliate of the Red Sox is no longer playing in Rhode Island.
Sure.
After so long. I think Tuesday will just be another day where that reality gets slammed home again.
Yeah, for real, yeah. We'll actually see the stadium and the team playing on the field and know that they're not here in Rhode Island anymore.
Right. And you know my position on this. I've been pretty consistent with it throughout. I feel like there was a deal to be made there. I feel like there was a conclusion that could have been reached between the two sides, and I don't necessarily think that the appetite was so great for it on the political side. I also believe that there was a communication breakdown there between the two sides, and you know as well as I do, because you've been married for as long as you have, in order to have any sort of successful relationship between two people, two entities, you need to be communicating.
Sure.
And you need to be clear and honest about where you stand, your feelings, your objectives. And I think at some point, those discussions between ownership and state government, I think there was an absence of that. And I think that's how we've ended up here with the Worcester Red Sox opening Polar Park and playing their first home game in franchise history on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting for the folks in Worcester County and the fans in that area. I look forward to getting up there at some point this season to check it out. But still, it'll be bittersweet knowing that, particularly the way it happened here and the fact that they didn't really have a chance to really say goodbye because of the pandemic. McCoy Stadium was closed, and it was really just a practice facility for the Red Sox last season, and they didn't really have that last season that they were expecting to have. So, good luck to the Worcester Red Sox, both from a baseball standpoint and from the standpoint of rehabbing an area of an old city and breathing some new life into it and bringing some more development to an area that could definitely use it. Gee, I wonder if there are any old cities here in Rhode Island that could have used that.
Maybe a couple. Yeah.
But anyway, Bill, we don't want to open that can of worms because we will certainly. There's certainly plenty of people on the other side who are saying, "Well, I'm glad we dodged that bullet."
Of course,
but of course. Anyway,
yeah.
So the Red Sox are going to be wrapping up their trip to Baltimore. Talking about stadiums and Larry Lucchino. Every time I watch the Orioles play at home, I always say, what a great ball. I mean, I've been to it several times.
Mm-hmm.
What a great ballpark, Camden Yards. And it always shows so well.
That's
on
fantastic.
TV, too.
It is.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just being able to go watch a game there and have a beer out in the warehouse area there and get some crab cakes or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of one of the older new stadiums now.
It was sort of that,
like, 93, 94 or something like that.
Yeah, it was that first stadium in this new wave of construction.
Right.
And it was, you know, again, Janet Marie Smith should probably be in the Baseball Hall of Fame, really, if we're being honest, considering the projects that she's worked on. Somehow managed to build a modern stadium with a retro feel.
Yeah.
And it's just so intimate, cozy, comfortable, while being modern at the same time. It's an absolute gem. And as it stands here, you know, more than a quarter century later,
yeah,
still feels new.
Yeah. No, and it still feels new, and I haven't been in probably 5 or 6 years, but every time I go there, it shines. You know, it looks great.
Yeah.
They're right on top of it and stuff. Which kind of makes you wonder, you know, are the Red Sox ever going to leave Fenway Park after all that $250 million plus that they've spent on it? Probably a lot more than that.
You're really trying to get me in trouble on this podcast, aren't you?
Well, I know where you stand on this. I'm not trying to get you in trouble, but, you know, it's... anyway. Fenway's the idea of Fenway is great, but the practical reality of Fenway stinks.
He said it, not me, folks.
Right, right.
He said it.
No, but I think most people can agree on that. I mean, it's a great old ballpark in terms of just the history of it, and they've done, I think they've done wonders with it, and they've done everything they can do to the, you know, for the most part.
Yes,
but realistically, you can't change where it is.
Nope.
It's difficult to get to.
Yep.
Parking's a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, hey, it's a 109-year-old stadium.
Right.
People weren't as big as they are, as big then as they are now. It's the seats are cramped. The aisles are cramped. You know, it's just there. You, if you're trying to do it all within that, in that footprint, you know, it's tough. And From the standpoint of the baseball players, and why do, you know, fans don't care about this? But, you know, the amenities just don't stack up in terms of space of the clubhouse and all that other stuff that a lot of these other newer parks have. But with all that said, it's hard to imagine the Red Sox leaving that stadium just after they're so. Just the identity of the Red Sox and Fenway Park go hand in hand.
Right.
And the political realities being what they are, it's hard to imagine them being able to put the Fenway. Put a park that, where else are they going to put it? They wanted to do it in South Boston. That didn't fly. So, I mean, just the realities of doing it somewhere in Boston, you know, seem kind of a long shot. And, you know, would it be the same if they built it in Foxborough? You know what I mean? Would they be the New England Red Sox? You know,
it's a major tourist attraction, and it's a living museum all in one.
That's
really.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you think about the history of it, and as you said, the ownership group has put a ton of work into it. You know, trying to modernize it. You know, trying to enlarge concourses, put in new seating. You know, they've obviously added the roof deck and the monster seats, and, you know, they've
and everything they've done has been great.
It's been great.
Yeah, I mean, there's no knock on what they've done.
Not
because,
at all.
I mean, the monster seats are, you know, I've been up there once. It's a novelty thing, and it's cool. I don't know that I'd want to be there, but, you know, just that's thinking outside the box.
Absolutely.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and that whole right field area roof deck is fantastic with the big bar up there, and. You know, they've certainly maximized, I think, the space that they could maximize. I mean, it's, you know, there are certain limitations with a structure that old. But still, it's a 109-year-old ballpark with cramped seatings and tough to get to and tough parking and narrow aisles. And, you know, if you try to get up to the fifth floor press box, you got to wait, you know, 6 or 7 trips before the elevator. I mean, who else cares about that? No one else cares. But, you know, these are the realities of working sometimes at Fenway Park.
You tolerate it because it's Fenway Park.
Right.
And because it's historic and because it's legendary. You know, I would equate it to sort of going to New Orleans, let's say. You know, New Orleans as a city is pretty much like a fraternity basement with with better food and great music.
I've never been, but I'll take your word.
You love it because it's New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's novel, and it's old, and it's unique and quaint in certain spots. You know, part of you would say we should knock down the whole thing and start over, you know, because you built it in on a floodplain, you know, and you've got buildings decaying in certain spots that aren't necessarily the greatest.
Right.
But the parts that make it stand out, the jazz clubs and the restaurants and Bourbon Street,
sure,
are all fantastic. You wouldn't trade them for anything,
and
there isn't anything like them anywhere else in the world.
Right. Right.
You know, Fenway is very much the same way. You know, if you want some kind of modern park and you happen to be a 6'3" person, and you want a beer and maybe, you know, some sort of different food, you're going to have to go to Petco Park,
yeah,
or to Camden Yards or somewhere like that. Fenway isn't going to be your place. You know, but if you'd like to be steeped in the history and the tradition and sort of, you know, being a place that's been around for over 100 years and a place where Babe Ruth played and Cy Young pitched and, you know, Roger Clemens pitched and Ted Williams played and Carl Yastrzemski played, like, all that stuff is why you still have Fenway Park.
You know, and one thing that we're maybe shortchanging too is the area right around Fenway is party zone too, you know.
Sure.
Lansdowne Street and Jersey Street, which is no longer Yorkie Way, but you know, that whole area that they kind of block off and people can walk around, and there's souvenir shops and the sausage guys and the hot dog guy and the, you know, that plays into it. That's not in Fenway Park, but that also plays into it. And not every ballpark really has that.
No, and they've committed to doing a major renovation project in the neighborhood. They're going to be new commercial spaces.
Yep.
If you go, you know, on the Boylston Street side of Fenway, there's been major residential development, apartment buildings built there,
yep,
you know, restaurants and shops coming in there. You know, they've certainly built around Fenway, and I think that was a big part of my argument to build a ballpark here in Rhode Island for the Paw Sox, is you use the stadium as an anchor.
Right.
It's a very clear statement. We're going to be here. We're investing here. We're going to spend money here. There's going to be people coming here. Come and live next to us. Open your restaurant. Open your business next to us. There will be people around. I think, you know, I remember when the ownership discussions were going on and they were talking about possibly building in South Boston. Frank McCourt owned a parcel of land in South Boston. He was one of the bidders for the team. Ultimately, he ended up buying the Dodgers. The Red Sox got very lucky in that way because he had a disastrous divorce, was in major financial trouble, and got bailed out by Guggenheim Partners, who now own the Dodgers. They're multi-billionaires, obviously have been able to spend and invest on the Dodgers, on Dodger Stadium,
yep,
have built a really good organization that wins, that's won a World Series, that's revitalized one of the coolest stadiums in
sure,
baseball.
Yeah.
But the idea that Fenway Park could be somewhere else, not in that place,
yeah,
that the Red Sox could play somewhere else and not in that place.
Yeah, it doesn't compute.
It's very strange,
yeah,
to think. You know, with the realities of the park being what they are, it's still very difficult to envision the Red Sox playing anywhere else.
Well, this is a discussion that we could have for hours and hours, and I'm sure we can revisit it at some point. So I think this will wrap up this edition of the Twin Bills. The Red Sox will welcome the American League West into the historic confines of Fenway this week. The surprising Oakland A's, I believe, come in, I want to say, Tuesday.
Tuesday.
And then I think they have the Angels coming in over the weekend.
Correct.
So we'll be watching closely, and we will be interested to hear your take on the opening night at Polar Park next time we convene here in the lovely downtown Providence studios for our next Twin Bills. Bill, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.